Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. We're here every noon Eastern Time, noon to 1 p.m., and I'm Allison Rose Levy. I'm a health journalist for 25 years, a Huffington Post blogger, as well as your host here on Connect the Dots Radio. We were just listening to our theme music, The Garden, by Bobby McFerrin, from his new CD, Vocabularies. And this week I want to give out a special Valentine's Day shout-out to all of you for a wonderful week of love within, love without, and love connecting. And part of that that I'm happy to announce too is that Vocabularies, from which our theme music comes, has been nominated for 3 different Grammys. And Bobby McFerrin, the brilliant musician who created that music, will actually be co-hosting a pre-Grammy telecast live streaming Sunday, February 15th in the afternoon. And you can go to www.grammy.com for more information. Here in Connect the Dots, we talk more about health as being more than just diet and exercise. Our attitudes and beliefs about health, our total health environment, all affect personal health. And so do decisions we make as a society about health care, food, regulation of chemicals, energy, and how we regulate and study the safety of many new products and industries and services that come along and impact our health. On today's show, we have a very special guest who's really a specialist in bridging a huge area that really is the next phase, I think, of really understanding and improving our health, and that is the connection between health and the environment. You know, the environment, obviously, we're not talking even just big picture global warming. We're talking about all of the things that we kind of have freely used and put into the environment who have found their way into our products as well as into earth, air, water, food, and, you know, even your kids' pajamas, you know, that contain substances that haven't been that well understood in terms of how they affect our health. So we're going to be joining us today on the show is Dr. Richard Clapp, and I'm so thrilled to have him with us. He is one of the real pioneers in looking into the scientific research to find out how toxins that we allow into the environment actually affect us and our children, to contribute to many of the diseases that we later, you know, are struggling to cure later in the game. Dr. Clapp is actively involved with the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, as well as with Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families. So we'll talk more about this on this segment of the show. And Dr. Clapp, I feel it's a privilege for myself and our listeners to have you on the show with us. Welcome.
Well, thank you. It's my pleasure to be able to do this.
We had actually first chatted during a press conference that was held a couple of weeks back, and so we'll kind of begin with that and give our readers a little heads up on some new research that was that recently came out just in the last couple of weeks, and that is a study that found that pregnant women in the United States have multiple chemicals, including many that were actually have been banned for over 3 decades, you know, carry them in their bodies, and we know that they also are, that infants in utero are therefore exposed to them and that there are health consequences. Can you kind of bring our listeners a little bit up to date about this surprising development?
Yeah, well, I think the new information is about pregnant women and therefore their newborns. There's been what's called biomonitoring studies going on in this country for several years now, and they show the same chemicals in the average population that you're talking about, these what are called persistent bioaccumulative toxins, things like polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs is the nickname. Those have been found in people's blood, actually, in these national surveys that have been going on from the Centers for Disease Control for several years. What was new about this recent study that Dr. Tracy Woodruff and her colleagues at the University of California, San Francisco did was they looked specifically at pregnant mothers. Typically, those are not people who are included in these biomonitoring studies. So sure enough, these chemicals wound up in pregnant mothers' blood as well.
That's really alarming, because I know that, you know, the very instinct of, you know, mothering and having a child is that you want to protect it from harm and give it space to be healthy and all of that. And so even understanding that moms, before they even become moms, and then as they are pregnant and carrying their children, are in fact already reflecting some of the pollution that we have in our society. And the concern there is also that then some of that will also be passed down in utero to the children. And biomonitoring is also showing that, is it not?
Yeah. Not only in utero and exposure in utero, but even in mother's breast milk.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the same kind of persistent toxins can show up in breast milk, especially if they're fat-soluble, like PCBs. So there's a phrase that was, I think, coined by a group called the Environmental Working Group, that babies in this country are now being born pre-polluted.
Mm-hmm.
And that phrase was taken up actually by the President's Cancer Panel, U.S. President's Cancer Panel, when they released a report last May and, you know, raised that as a concern, that children are being born with exposure in utero and then actually with some level of exposure that they're already carrying when they're born, and then it gets, to some extent, carried forward by their mother's breast milk.
So this is really alarming, and we really, if a chemical is persisting in tissue for 30 years, that also tells us, I mean, it tells us two things. One is biomonitoring is something that is done, you know, especially in research. It's not a regular part of practice, so that of healthcare practice. So it's not that the average mom would know whether she's carrying chemicals and conferring them to her child or not. And also, we don't really apart from perhaps some integrative health detox protocols, which may, you know, may not be helpful in addressing some things and, you know, perhaps not others. If something is persisting in the body for over three decades and in the environment for over three decades, I mean, I guess that tells us how successfully we're able to naturally or even with help detoxify from these.
Right. I mean, we're talking about a subset of chemicals. Not all chemicals are like this.
Right.
Some don't last in the environment very long at all.
Mm-hmm.
But the ones that are the most concerned are what are these so-called persistent bioaccumulative toxins. And DDT is another one that we haven't yet mentioned, but that was what Rachel Carson was warning about in Silent Spring five decades ago. And it's still with us. It's still in our house dust, in my house dust, actually, in my house, and we haven't used DDT since we've lived here, but prior generations have. So for example, that's one chemical that lasts a very long time. There's another one that I perhaps should mention, which is called PFOA. That's the nickname. That's the initials for perfluorooctanoic acid. And it's a chemical that's used to make Teflon. That also is showing up. That's one where one of the chemists that has been examining this has called the half-life of that chemical in the environment geologic. In other words, it almost never breaks down. So that's one that it's again fairly recent, because we didn't used to have Teflon, right? It was
mm-hmm.
it was created post World War II, but then it wound up showing up in people's drinking water in Parkersburg, West Virginia, a couple of decades ago. And so then the EPA and Centers for Disease Control began looking at PFOA, and sure enough, it's everywhere. And it's in my house dust. I've had my own house dust tested. So, and we don't use we don't have Teflon in our pots and pans. So it's been there from previous generations.
Mm. So in fact, you know, some people are still using Teflon pans, and there are things that we are still putting out today that we could, you know, perhaps stop, have all of the chemicals been studied so that we know, which ones are having these kinds of effects. I mean, how good a job are we doing in terms of monitoring and assessing what we have, what we're producing today that may be having either health harming or long term effects?
Well, that's the big question. I mean, that's the reason for chemicals. That's why chemicals reform is on the agenda and why bills were introduced last year in Congress, was to bring the system that we have in this country up to speed to get ahead of this problem and not be putting chemicals like PFOA out into the environment without adequate testing. It's sort of to catch up with Europe. This is a program you probably know, or your readers may know, your listeners may know, that there's something called a REACH program in the European Union that's an attempt to require further testing or more complete testing of new chemicals before they're put on the market. And then for those that are already on the market, require in a sort of phased way additional testing of things like reproductive effects and immunologic effects or endocrine disrupting effects that haven't been tested up until now. And then if there are safer alternatives, use those.
Well, you know, I think that's really, a step in the right direction. One of the things that we talk about a lot on this program is the fact that, for people who are kind of health empowered or well informed, and are addressing health at the personal level, there's the thought always, well, if I adjust my diet, if I do this, if I do that, I can, be resistant these kinds of things that are going on out there that, in a larger systemic level may not affect me, but in fact, some of them may affect us. It may affect our children. So it really is a kind of call to looking beyond the personal sphere to things that are affecting the personal, sphere of health. And so, you're mentioning the Safer Chemicals Act, which was introduced in this last year by Senator Frank Lautenberg, and I know there was a press conference about a week ago in which he raised this question again. I'd love your perspective about how that's doing in terms of what its likely prospects are for getting passed. The proposal is to change the regulatory stance, really, of the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, so that instead of allowing these things and kind of giving a blank check and then they're produced and they're out there and then, we kind of find out or suspect through long-term health issues that there's a problem, to really kind of put the requirement on manufacturers to, look into it, improve chemicals safe before we just freely allow their use. In fact, I think most people aren't aware that these are just, very untested, and it's really your own research that has, begun to kind of connect the dots on the fact that all of this is happening. Do you think people are more aware of this? Because, like, when you mentioned Teflon pans, for example, I mean, I don't use them, certainly. I don't use aluminum pans or anything. But I often find when I mention things like that to people, it's kind of you become like a bad news bear, It must be okay, or they wouldn't allow it there. Is there truth in that statement? It must be okay?
it's a broad statement or a broad question. I mean, it depends. There are, I think you were on the call when we were discussing pharmaceuticals, which also show up in our groundwater and sometimes in our drinking water. And how safe are those? Well, there's a regime for testing new drugs that's actually stricter and puts more requirements on the manufacturer of a new drug than, for example, typical chemicals that are in manufacturing. So I would say there's a distinction to be made between pharmaceutical chemicals and chemicals that are used to make products or that are used as solvents, for example, some sort of a process chemical. And I think that in this country we've had much too lax an approach toward manufacturing and process chemicals to the point where we now do have things. I mean, the PFOA that I mentioned, it's used in the manufacture of Teflon. It's not Teflon itself. It's something that helps Teflon, the chemical that becomes the Teflon coating, to spread over a surface. It's called a surfactant. PFOA is what's called a surfactant, and it's supposed to disappear, actually, after the product has been manufactured, so that it shouldn't be showing up in your house. Well, turns out there is residual. There's some left, even in people's pots and pans, and here's how this became known, that it was in people's homes, was that if you, say, for example, leave the flame on a gas burner or under a Teflon pot, and say walk away and forget that it's there, and it starts overheating and it gets smoky. Mm-hmm. That smoke is basically vaporizing what's in the Teflon, and that whatever residual PFOA is there becomes airborne. And this happened, and in the home where it was first discovered, it killed the parakeets, birds. So that's I guess you'd say that's an example of sort of a worst-case scenario where the heat has been left to get too high. Somebody wasn't watching the fry pan and started smoking. And then, you know, in that case, the pet bird was the canary in the mine, as it were.
Literally.
Yeah. And so, you know, how does this happen? Well, I mean, I think it is a failure of the regulatory system that allows even a chemical like that that's not supposed to be in a product to be there, to the point where it could expose people long after it has left the factory where it was made. You know, there's lots of examples we could give of chemicals that have been out and used in products and are still in the environment. I guess maybe in some ways the worst case is asbestos, which is banned in most industrial countries in the world. It's not banned in the United States, still used for lots of products. But asbestos, these are fibers. This is a mineral. This lasts, you know, again, forever. And we have it all throughout our environment. It shouldn't have been put out there in the first place. There are alternatives to fireproofing, which, of course, we're using now for certain things that don't require asbestos and are as effective. But, you know, there were decades during which this really dangerous, what's called Class A, Group 1, you know, known human carcinogen was put out into the environment. And we're still reaping the whirlwind, so to speak.
I would imagine that most people think, you know, that asbestos is long gone, unless it, you know, happens to be, you know, in an old house or something like that. I mean, I wouldn't imagine that, you know, they're realizing that it was still in use, for example. I mean, that's really a sort of a shocker. You know, one of the things also, because I covered for the Huffington Post, from which I've blogged for 3.5 years at this point, the President's Cancer Panel report that you referred to that came out, you know, spring ago, so last spring. And, you know, really this pointed the finger at a sort of increase in or a certain proportion of cancer risk really coming from an aggregate of these chemicals as being really a whole new needed area for research. And you know, beyond, you know, the cigarette smoking, which everyone agrees is obviously a major contributing factor and the like. But, you know, we're seeing a kind of, you know, it's like one friend of mine who works with an organization called Less Cancer said it's almost like cancer has become a regular stage of the human life cycle. And the President's Cancer Panel report pointed to the aggregate of these chemicals as being an important influence. So it's not just simply, you know, our scientific study is kind of, you know, we study the effect of one chemical and we start with the animals and then we kind of move up and we kind of document that that's a carcinogen. But what is happening to our health when we have multiple carcinogens, endocrine disruptors, as you mentioned, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about them, you know, not just one, but, you know, multiple in aggregate at different levels for different people, all kind of impacting us. I mean, how does that change our health picture from your perspective?
Well, the first question was about the carcinogens and, you know, the rate of cancer in this country, and this is adjusted for age, as people get older, they've adjusted the statistics to show that there's been this dramatic increase in cancer in the United States population for as long as there have been good statistics captured about this, and that's going back at least 40 years. It's begun to come down recently, and that's thank God, because cigarette smoking-related cancers, especially lung cancer in men, have begun to come down. And recently, breast cancer in females has begun to come down, presumably because of the less use of hormone replacement therapy. So those are two of the three major cancers. So the pattern has begun to level off, at least, and in the case of male lung cancer, begun to come down very recently. And it's still a much higher level of cancer per 100,000 people in the population, and again, adjusted for age, than we had in the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. So my way of explaining that is that the reason we have so much cancer is because we're exposed to so many carcinogens. Sort of a no-brainer, but I mean, I think that's inevitably the reason, right? It's not like genetics mm-hmm. have changed.
Mm-hmm.
It's not even that obesity explains the whole thing. Or again, I think cigarette smoking declining in males does explain some of the recent decline, but it doesn't explain non-Hodgkin's lymphoma or kidney cancer or several of the other types that are also still going up or have been going up that are probably more related to chemical exposures, chemical carcinogens.
Mm-hmm.
And then with respect to childhood diseases, for example, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, as it sometimes is called, or learning disabilities, there does appear to be an increase of those as well in children. And again, these may, it's harder to study the patterns of these things because there aren't state laws requiring reporting of this, so it depends on either clinicians noticing and talking about it, pediatricians, for example, or school systems noticing they have a lot more kids needing learning disability support services. But that does seem to be the case. And the causes of that, I think, are less obvious than the carcinogens causing cancer kind of story that I said.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What is the role played by endocrine disruptors? Because, one of the things, I think there's this general sense, at no time before in history have we had this kind of concern to deal with, really. And so I think my sense in terms of, as a popular writer and working with and dialoguing with the public all the time, looking at people's kind of attitudes and beliefs about health, the general sense is that, when it's released into the environment, it's a big wide world, it just kind of went away. If it's a little teeny bit of this or that or whatever, my body can handle it. If something is active in a very minuscule amount and really could have a profound change in the way the body regulates and manages itself, that's something that's kind of goes against the grain of our, let's say, uninformed hope about, how some of these toxins might be affecting us. Can you kind of shine a little light on that for our listeners?
I'll give it a try. For example, an example of an endocrine disrupting chemical is something that causes plastics to become more pliable. It's called a plasticizer. And phthalates are the chemical name of a group of chemicals that do that. They make plastic more pliable, or they make, for example, plastic tubing easier to bend. Or make your shower curtains, for example, pliable and not stiff. Or in some cases, actually, they used to spray them in cars to give it a new car smell. Those are phthalates.
Ooh.
And so those are now known to be, some of them in particular, are quite strong endocrine disruptors. In other words, they mimic, say, estrogen or some other hormone that's normally present in the body, but this is an extra dose that you're getting by being exposed to something that's in a plastic product.
Mm-hmm.
Or here's another way that people are exposed, and this has already changed, but IV bottles that are used in healthcare,
mm-hmm.
Or the plastic tubing that's used to deliver, an intravenous fluid through a catheter into a child in a hospital, for example, those plastic materials that either the IV bag or the tubing were found to contain phthalates and such to such an extent that they were actually being delivered along with the therapeutic dose of whatever it was that they were going along with. And so the manufacturers, when that became known, the manufacturers of those IV bags and tubes figured out a way to make them without phthalates.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that a group called Healthcare Without Harm actually raised. We want healthcare to be delivered. Don't we want healthcare to be delivered in a way that by itself doesn't increase harm to the patient? And the medical profession, of course, says, of course, right? That's what we mm-hmm. that's what we want. But it took some pretty good detective work by a number of people, scientists and even companies like Baxter, I think it was, that were manufacturing these things to say, whoops, this isn't what we want here with these phthalates showing up in you know, the IV tubes. So that's changed. I guess that's, I would call that a success story. But we have, you know, I think it's a question of constant vigilance for this kind of thing.
So the idea is that if you, you know, it doesn't take a big wallop of something if you're actually, if a chemical is having an impact like the phthalates that you mentioned on the hormonal system, that it's actually getting in there and sort of either supplanting or interacting in some way, shifting the hormonal mechanisms that run a lot of other different systems in the body. Is that the concern with endocrine disruptors? Or?
Yep, that's the idea. And it's also, it's partly that it's little bits add up, little bits from your, you know, shower curtain, or little bits from your, if you're in a healthcare situation through some IV, those are perhaps more dramatic examples, but even little bits that are in your house dust from products that have been there by yourself, put there by yourself or previous owners, all of that adds to a collective dose. And it's a sort of, it's a little bit here and there begins to add up to a bigger bit. The other thing to point out is that you know, there's this phrase, the dose makes the poison. Well, I think Dr. Woodruff and others have pointed out that it's the dose and the timing of the dose that makes the poison. So a prenatal dose of the same amount that you might get as an adult could be much more harmful because of the developing organism, you know, the fetus still in the womb. Mm-hmm. Than a similar dose per unit body weight later in life. So that's another, I wouldn't call that a subtlety, that's a new understanding of not only is it this cumulative dose, but when we get it, that's important.
Mm-hmm. So that, in fact, it's, you know, for an adult, it's like it's adding up. And then, you know, maybe it's contributing with life stressors or other, you know, diet or other factors, some of which, you know, we have some or more or less control over. And so you don't know what point it adds up to. And then suddenly you have symptoms and, an illness progressing. Whereas also there's a concern for adults. But then the other side of the coin is it for young children who receive, you know, exposures as in utero, as infants, babies, as young children, you know, it's actually getting in there and beginning to shift things as they are developing, growing, their body is forming. And so we don't even know, perhaps yet, with the increase in use of toxic chemicals, we know that there are some increases in childhood ailments, the ones that you mentioned now, but we also don't know what the lifelong trajectory of that could look like for this next generation. Or do we? I mean,
No, you're right, we don't. And that's, as I said, constant vigilance, that's the watchword for the research community that's interested in, for example, children's health. And there is a major effort now, a child health study that's underway in this country to try to take a comprehensive look at the exposures that might affect children's health over the next couple of decades. And if there are warning signals that are picked up, you know, move to prevent harmful exposures sooner rather than later, rather than waiting until the damage is done. So that is what is happening. There's a whole cadre of researchers that are focused on that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. You know, and you've said a couple of points along the way about how the body does have a way of clearing some of this stuff. Mm-hmm. And so small doses at the right time, you know, for example, when you've got a fully developed immune system, might be handled by the body. And that's the good news. In fact, you know, one conservative take on this is, well, how come we're not all dying like flies, right, with all this stuff in our environment? I have to say it's partly because we do have a, you know, fairly resilient biology as a species and relatively, and it could be worse. It could have been worse, but for that. And the other thing is that, you know, are we having the quality of life that we could have, even if we're living longer on average, we know? We live now into, I think, the male lifespan is 79 or maybe even 80 now, and females a little bit longer. And whereas when our parents were growing up, when my parents were growing up, it was 10 or 15 years shorter than that. So something is going right. That, I think, is true in terms of the length of life. But again, I think that what we're about is not only extending life so that we have, you know, long and productive lives, but also that we're their healthy lives and not, you know, sort of less robust than they could otherwise be or diminished in some way.
So, you know, perhaps, you know, before it's outright at, you know, a serious illness, one could be seeing a low energy, depression, weight gain, you know, a variety of the chronic health symptoms that we're seeing. Could you talk about that a little bit? You know, how this, you know, lies with, you know, or maybe influencing the massive shift toward chronic health problems in our society. You know, on the one hand, we were always like, let's conquer the germ, you know, let's get rid of that microbe, let's, you know, and we've kind of done almost too good a job in certain ways of doing that. But then we've had this rise of chronic disease. Is that connected to this?
Well, that's what we're facing now, is that you're right. We have, you know, for the most part, conquered the rampant infectious diseases that 100 years ago were the major killers. That's infectious diseases in the U.S. at least are not the major killers. Chronic diseases are: heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, neurological disease like Parkinson's disease. And the question is, how much of the burden that is now our chronic disease burden could we diminish? Could we lighten? And that's the task that the next generation has before it. You know, this is the other thing that will break the bank of Medicare, is the incredible costliness of chronic disease maintenance and, you know, extended care for people who are not dying but staying alive with lots of medical care needs. So the cost, if nothing else, is going to drive further efforts to prevent long-term chronic disease from increasing in the population, even as we get older.
And the chemical exposures can indeed be part of this.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. There's a group called Physicians for Social Responsibility. You probably know of that group, and your listeners do. And they just produced a report, actually, on healthy aging and what it would take to have healthier aging. I commend that to your listeners. It's available online through the Physicians for Social Responsibility. And it was a careful look by, you know, talented scientists, Drs. Ted Shetler, Jill Stein, Maria Valenti, and others worked on this product. And it's a very, and it came out about a year ago now, I think, a very careful look at what part of the chronic disease burden could be diminished so we have healthier aging.
That's a very important question. Also because, you know, the aging population is staying in the workforce longer as well. And, that's really, and you know, trying not to become or not wanting to be a burden. So I think that sounds like a really terrific report. You know, we're going to come up here on the break that we have in the show. And when we come back, I actually have some questions. I've invited people to tweet me at Allison Rose Levy, or to send questions on my Facebook page, Allison Rose Levy, and we do have a question for you when we get back. And I'm also going to do our featured action of the week and point towards some places that, both in terms of your terrific work at Lowell, as well as Safer Chemicals and other places that people can go to take action on some of this. Because I think the big takeaway message for our listeners is, you know, proactive health is both individual health and it's also on the society level. So we're talking, you know, really about being proactive for our health here. So stay with us.
Listening to PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists, because this is the one form that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
Every Sunday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, join the founders of the Godspeed Institute for Spiritual Learning, Carol and Michael Hallenbeck, for Godspeed, an enlightening and informative journey into the world's religions and spiritual belief systems. Through conversations with experts worldwide, this weekly live call-in program is an on-air classroom aimed at helping listeners gain exposure to and insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world. Every Sunday, 2 to 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Mike Adams, the editor-in-chief and key writer of naturalnews.com and co-founder of the nonprofit site consumerwellness.org. I'll be starting a special segment on the Progressive Radio Network called The Health Ranger with Mike Adams. I'll be interviewing everyone from Dr. Jane Goodall to Suzanne Summers. Find out the latest in natural healing news and easy ways to live a healthier and more holistic lifestyle. So tune in on Saturdays at 6 p.m. Eastern every week on the Progressive Radio Network to hear The Health Ranger with Mike Adams.
Driving you crazy? Do you have a cheating boyfriend or girlfriend? An ex you can't let go of? An obnoxious boss? Adult kids who won't listen? I'm Hollis Polk, and I fix relationship problems. Your life, your relationship with Hollis Polk offers you practical solutions for all sorts of people problems. Listen and call in Wednesdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, 3 p.m. Pacific, or download the podcast at ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Hello, I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and you can hear my program, If You Love This Planet, right here on the Progressive Radio Network, every Sunday at 3 p.m. Please join me as I interview a huge variety of special guests from around the world about a range of topics, including the health of the planet and prescriptions for survival. So, if you do love this planet, tune in to the Progressive Radio Network every Sunday at 3 p.m.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Welcome back, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, a health journalist and Huffington Post reporter, and my guest on the show today is Dr. Richard Clapp, a pioneering
epidemiologist who looks at the connection, I always have trouble pronouncing that, between environment and health. And we'll be talking more with him in just a minute. I wanted to let you know what our health actions are for the week, because I'm sure that having listened to the first segment of the show, a lot of you would like to know what you can do to be involved and do more to help protect our society and our kids and our health, you know, from the impact of unregulated chemicals, and kind of really get a handle on regulating them for safety and controlling their use to protect our health and the health of future generations. So first off, I wanted to let everyone know of an organization which Dr. Clapp works with very intensively. It's a terrific organization with a really great website. It's called the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production, and you can find it online at www.sustainableproduction.org. They have a wide range of different initiatives and a wealth of wonderful health information, research, links to studies, terrific articles to inform yourself about a wide range of different issues, such as the ones we've been discussing on today's Connect the Dots with Dr. Clapp. And they also have articles on green toys, on food safety. They have initiatives for controlling toxins in the environment, research into, you know, some of the questions that we've been really getting answers to on the show, and how chemicals can become toxic to us, as well as policy initiatives to change that. So, you know, please do go to that website. And if you didn't get the link, I also have that link, as well as all of the links for the actions and connections that I'm about to mention, are all together on my blog today at healthjournalistblog.com, and that'll be up this week, this whole week, and really linking to the featured action of the week, as well as, you know, to the Lowell Center. So you can go there and copy down anything that you miss. Our two actions for the week are really these. As we talked about earlier in the show, Senator Lautenberg, who sponsored the Safer Chemicals Act, is really reinitiating that dialogue and look into that in this year's Congress. And you can also sign up with an organization called Safer Chemicals Healthy Families in order to be part of that discussion, weigh in, let your Congress people know that you want to see these chemicals regulated for our health and safety. So you can go there and sign up. And again, this is also on my blog, but if you have your pens ready, it's at www.saferchemicals.org. You can sign up, and they will let you know and send you actions. Right now, this has kind of been, since the effort last year to move on this, it's kind of been quiet for a little while, but they're gearing up again, and there will be actions and opportunities to let the people that you elect and who have a voice in Congress know about your priorities for health and safety. So please do sign up with them. I also regularly blog on these topics on the Huffington Post, as well as discuss them on this radio program, as well as have multiple links for actions, you know, on a weekly basis. So you can also sign up at healthjournalistblog.com to receive my weekly e-zine with a featured action, with the radio announcements, and with blogs on these topics, and you're very welcome to do that as well. And this week we also have a second action. Again, it's on the blog this week because the Republican Congress is proposing to cut funding for public television, PBS, and NPR public radio. So this is, you know, something that we kind of have to keep having pushback on in order to retain our public media and the independent voices that we do have. So there is a link that you'll find to MoveOn.org, which is sponsoring an action and a petition to preserve the budgets for our public broadcasting. So please do go there and do that. And so now I'm returning, which I know that, you know, you've been waiting for, to our dialogue with Dr. Richard Clapp. And Dr. Clapp, I have a question for you from someone who's written in. wanting to know if there are any studies linking leukemia to synthetics, such as benzene feedstocks, BPA, pesticides, you know, things like that. They have a specific interest in that area. Are you aware of anything of that nature?
Yeah, I have. I have a couple of examples. In fact, one of the articles that you mentioned that's on the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production website is a review of childhood cancer. And the two biggest causes of cancer, or the biggest types of cancer in children, are leukemia, that's number one, and brain cancer. And so there's a review which I participated in of the scientific evidence that supports that some pesticides do seem to be linked to childhood leukemia. If their children are exposed, and also if their parents are exposed. Another synthetic chemical that has been linked to childhood leukemia is called trichloroethylene. It's actually a solvent. The nickname is TCE. It's found in a lot of contaminated drinking water supplies and at a lot of Superfund sites. And it was the chemical, the primary chemical that was in the drinking water in Woburn, Massachusetts, when a childhood leukemia cluster was discovered, that subsequently was described in a book called A Civil Action and a movie called A Civil Action. It was a synthetic chemical called trichloroethylene. It's not actually benzene related, but it's a chlorinated hydrocarbon compound that's used as a solvent. And then that same chemical was also found in the drinking water in a town called Toms River, New Jersey, and also there linked to childhood leukemia, especially prenatal. In both of these, it was especially prenatal exposure that put the kids at increased risk later of being diagnosed with leukemia. And also was in Camp Lejeune's drinking water, the Camp Lejeune base in North Carolina, which has been in the news most recently because of excess of male breast cancer. But at least there are some cases, at least, of childhood leukemia amongst kids who were born at Camp Lejeune when their drinking water was contaminated with trichloroethylene. So it's, you know, I think the evidence is pretty powerful, actually, that that chemical and then some other synthetic chemicals can cause childhood leukemia.
Thank you. And, you know, that's going out to Renee asking a question about this, and I'm sure she's listening. I'm sure that was very helpful. You know, since you mentioned chemicals in water, too, I'm not sure if we had touched on this during the press conference or not where we spoke, but I'll mention it again, and regular listeners, you know, to the program as well as subscribers to my e-zine know that I'm also one of the issues that I focus on along with food, toxic chemicals, and, you know, other health-related initiatives is the new use of over, you know, 500 to 600 different kinds of toxic chemicals in a new form of the old process of gas drilling has kind of been changed so that to something called hydraulic fracturing or fracking, where high volume chemicals are mixed with water and sent down into the geology of the earth, where, you know, because of unstable geographic, it's not just, you know, pristine and like ironclad down there, you know, it can seep, it does seep. There are also spills or evaporation, explosions, and through other means it enters water supplies, you know, and people are drinking it with various health consequences. So that might be another possible area of study. I don't know if you were, you know, if that had come to your attention yet, the, you know, the concern over gas drilling.
Absolutely. I mean, fracking is, you know, all the rage right now, and you know, it's touted as a way to diminish our energy dependence in the Middle East oil supplies and all of that. So there's lots of attention. Sandra Steingraber, I'm sure you and your listeners know, has taken this up because she's actually over one of the aquifers that's at risk because of hydrofracking. And she's written an article that she, I think, uses the title "The Whole Fracking Enchilada" to describe all the things that you just said, all the various ways that this could be a real disaster.
Well, I am also in an at-risk region, and I've been covering this on the Huffington Post regularly for the last year and a half, and also, you know, so I'll also give a plug here for the film Gasland, which really has brought this to very broad attention as well, and has been nominated for an Academy Award. So, you know, in another couple of weeks, we're going to see if it wins. And the gas industry, we've had members of the grassroots organizing groups from New York State that are trying to protect the water supply and the organic agriculture of New York State, as well as the water supply, actually the with the drilling in the Delaware River Valley region, as well as, you know, potential areas that could affect the New York reservoirs, New York City reservoirs. You know, there are actually people in New York City, in Philadelphia, in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, in Delaware, you know, really are all at risk for, you know, potential exposure based upon government, you know, legislative decisions and regulatory decisions that will be determined as we speak. So I do a lot of action links to that. So people are also, you know, strongly encouraged to sign up. And it also would seem that, you know, this is an area for further scientific research into what these chemicals are, because there's, you know, there hasn't been a requirement. They've been exempted from, you know, the Clean Drinking Water Act and others. Is there any move afoot among scientists to kind of, you know, try to take a look at what we're actually being exposed to here?
Oh, yes. I mean, scientists, hopefully some of them read the newspapers as well and keep up with the latest developments and get interested in things like this. I have colleagues that are interested in this exact thing, and also the full disclosure of what the fracking fluids contain is, I think, beginning to happen now as a result. So maybe we'll know more about this a year from now than we do now. But then, yeah, the long-term effects, how it affects water supplies, we'll have to be constantly vigilant about.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll stay in touch with you on that, too. You know, it's funny because one of our listeners has written in to ask, and I don't know that I don't feel qualified to answer this question, and I don't know what you'll say to it either. But I'm going to ask you. And I think it's a wonderful question, because this is how we, as kind of I speak also to, you know, kind of a health aware, health conscious, personally proactive audience, and so this is the classic kind of way that we think as, you know, kind of health proactive people, but it's, you know, but there's also an irony in it for me. But, you know, so our questioner, who I know is a health advocate, asks, where is the healthiest place to live in the USA? Which area has the cleanest air and purest water? In other words, how do we get away from these problems? Do you have an answer to that for her?
Well, not off the top. I mean, if you were to look at the sort of lowest death rates, especially the lowest death rates from cancer, mm-hmm. it's the mountain states. You know, it's the Utah, Colorado, I guess, sort of the mountain states east of California that would have the lowest death rates for certain types of disease. Now, that I don't necessarily think that's where you might want to move. There are a lot of factors that would go into where somebody who doesn't live there already might choose whether they want to move there or not. I personally like being in a state. I live in Massachusetts, and there are other states like Vermont in the Northeast where people are, as a population, quite health conscious, even if our death rates don't reflect it. So we take note and we try to take action. You've mentioned the Lowell Center for Sustainable Production. That's an example of trying to take action. And for people who are politically active, this is a good place to do that in the state of Massachusetts, whereas I think political action in Utah is tough. And
yeah, pretty much so, yep. Right. Mm-hmm. And also in Colorado, I have to say, there has been a lot of this fracking, you know, in Colorado, and there has been contamination in Colorado. So, you know, so what you're proposing as a solution, and I agree with this, is, you know, we're not going to be able to, you know, find health when we don't create health on the planet so readily, you know. So it's really about stepping up to take action for health. Actually, this issue came up in the press conference that we were on. where it was very poignant. Another one of the speakers that spoke in addition to you was a mom who had very tragically lost a young daughter under the age of 4 to breast cancer. And, you know, she was asking herself all the questions that people who become ill ask, which parents ask, how did they get this? What did I do? What decision? What could have led to this? You know, could I have done something differently? So she was really, it was heart-wrenching hearing her. And then one of the reporters for a popular health website that shall be nameless got on and said, well, what can people do to, you know, protect themselves? And the answer was take action. You know, so, you know, I think a real point of this program, Connect the Dots, is, you know, we're used to taking individual action if we're health conscious, but really the time has come, especially if we hope and plan to have children and families or hope to have grandchildren, my generation, you know, to really take action. And yet, you know, people have, you know, some people that comes naturally to, and others kind of, you know, don't think to do that. One of the quotes that is on, you know, your website there at the Lowe Center, which I thought was really terrific, is from Paul Hawken, and this goes to some of your other work that you do there too. He says, the ideas and much of the technology required for the redesign of our businesses and the restoration of our world are already in hand. What is wanting is collective will.
Yep, that's it.
I'd love to hear what you have to say about that.
Well, first, before I do that, Alice, I want to correct it. The child died not of breast cancer. Yes, I think you said breast cancer was brain cancer.
Okay.
Christine
mm-hmm.
and her daughter's name was Mira, and it was a very poignant thing. You're right. But, you know, I guess another way to frame what Paul Hawken says is the way Margaret Mead did, which is if you really want to change things, I mean, you know, a small group of committed people can do it if they set themselves to the task. And that's the only way change really has ever happened, is when affected people or average citizens band together. I think that's our lesson of history, actually, in this country, that if you leave it to the plutocrats, so to speak, we're going to get a mess, or we're going to have an economy that literally falls apart. So that's our only protection against that is collective action. I think on Progressive Radio Network, that's not an unheard of point of view, and I certainly support it, and it's borne out in my life, actually.
Well, you know, I think on Progressive Radio Network, people are, you know, all across the board connecting the dots. But there are many, many people, you know, who still think of healthcare, even if they're not thinking about it in terms of, you know, my prescription and my doctor gives me my prescription for my health. That's most health information is really structured along those lines. You know, so if it's conventional medical care, then it's like what drug, what pill, what surgery, what can I take for my health? If it's integrative care, which is the kind that I've championed for 25 years, then it's what diet can I take? What omega-3 fatty acid should I do? You know, what is the healthiest green drink that I can have? You know, but it still is within the model of, you know, my health prescription. And, you know, one of my purposes in doing the kind of coverage is really to sort of broaden the picture to everything that's impacting our health. And that's what we try to do on this program. So another plug for Connect the Dots. And, you know, I we'd love to have you back again, really. This has been so terrific. It's just so incredibly valuable. And we just have a few seconds more, but I have a quick question if you think you could possibly fit it in, which is a mom has written in and said that sucralose or Splenda is an inactive ingredient in many childhood, you know, over-the-counter formulas like Tylenol or cough syrups or other things. You know, do you, I know that's a little bit outside of the realm of the phthalates and other things we've been discussing, you know, but what are the concerns about, you know, kind of hidden sort of normalized food ingredients, you know, in medical care and other substances?
Well, you know, that actually is a good question for Dr. Sean Palfrey, who was another person that was on that call that we were on a couple of weeks ago. I'm not really up to date enough to give an intelligent answer about that. But
okay.
Sean Palfrey, Dr. Palfrey is, and then there are other pediatric specialist. Dr. Phil Landrigan is another one, pediatrician at the Mount Sinai Medical Center, that I would refer whoever posed that question to.
That's a good response, actually, and we know Dr. Landrigan, and maybe one day we'll have him on the show.
Yeah,
you know, it's just been terrific speaking with you, Dr. Clapp, and I just want to thank you for being with us, and also for all of the many years of work that you have done and are continuing to do in this regard, as well as, you know, kind of going on the hoof and sort of speaking up for these issues to both awaken government and awaken citizens to take action for health. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome, and thanks for having me on your program.
Tune in next week to Connect the Dots on PRN at noon on Saturdays.